Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, December 31st, 2006, the last day of the year, on a wonderful summer day this December in Urbana. It is truly beautiful today in the high 50s. I hope some of you are still by your radios, and those of you around the world joining us by computer or by podcast are enjoying the sort of weather we are here today. We're going to have a wonderful show for you today. We have as our guest Amy Goodman coming to us live from New York to talk to us about the state of the world and the state of the media and to take your calls. So please stay tuned, relax, and enjoy. We're going to have a great hour of Media Matters today. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Cell phone companies are further working to lock down just what consumers can and cannot do with their own phones on networks they've already paid to use. A senior executive at Google recently told an audience at Oxford University that several phone companies have approached Google about restricting cell phone users' abilities to use its Google Maps service. This is most likely because cell phone service providers want to roll out their own mapping applications, and while Google's is free, they want to charge for the service. Additionally, while some cell phone companies claim to offer free unlimited internet service in their plans, they do not allow consumers to use voice over IP phone services or watch too much streaming video over their phones. One of these companies is Nokia, which has upgraded the software on its network to blanket block all applications which use voice over IP technology. Nokia ultimately plans to sell this tool to other mobile phone providers by mid-2007. However, the U.S. Copyright Office recently ruled that cell phone users could hack the software that controls their phones in order to make them cross-compatible with competing service providers, hopefully doing away with the need to buy an entirely new phone when switching carriers. Some providers had previously claimed altering the proprietary software they install in phones to inhibit consumers' access to certain services violated copyright law. The U.S. Copyright Office, though, says such hacking to gain unauthorized access to services without paying for them is still illegal, but hacking a phone to ensure that it will continue to function is not.
NBC Universal is taking a cue from Sinclair Broadcasting and regionalizing the local news at several of its Spanish-language television stations owned by subsidiary Telemundo. Beginning in early 2007, the newscasts aired on Telemundo stations in Dallas, Houston, Las Vegas, and Phoenix will be produced from a facility just outside Fort Worth, Texas. It's all part of a $750 million cost-cutting plan NBC's undertaken at Telemundo. Sinclair Broadcasting pioneered the practice of cutting local TV news in favor of regionally produced fare in 2002, when it created its News Central division, which feeds prepackaged news from Baltimore to dozens of stations it owns around the country.
A government criminal case against a former phone company executive who stands accused of insider trading may be undermined by classified government documents that he will be allowed to use in his defense. Joe Nachio, the former CEO of Quest Communications, has been indicted on 42 counts of insider trading of Quest stock, from which he reaped a tidy $101 million, less than a year before Quest's share price took a dive. Nachio claims he was banking on the company receiving up to $500 million in secret government contracts following the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. A judge hearing Nachio's case in Denver recently ruled that he can use these classified government proposals in his defense, though it's not clear whether the company actually reaped such a windfall. If convicted on each of the 42 counts, Nachio could potentially receive a maximum sentence of more than 400 years in prison, though that is highly unlikely. At least one other Quest executive has already been convicted and sentenced as a result of the insider trading probe and is expected to turn state's evidence in the Nachio trial.
Project Censored, a media research group based out of Sonoma State University in California, has been tracking the flow of major news stories that go ignored or underreported in mainstream America for more than a dozen years now, and has come out with its list of top stories to watch out for in 2007. Number one on the list, the growth of debate over the principle of network neutrality and the groundswell of millions of Americans who actively engaged policymakers in defense of internet freedom. Project Censored found that in 2006, the net neutrality fight was all but ignored in the mainstream press and was nearly non-existent on TV, save for a handful of mentions on cable news programs. Number 8 on Project Censored's top 10 story list was a major exemption given to the Pentagon from the Freedom of Information Act, which extends through the end of 2007.
Just 2 weeks to go before the start of the National Conference for Media Reform, going down January 12th through the 14th in Memphis, Tennessee. Registration is still open. Join thousands of concerned citizens from all walks of life in organizing for a more democratic media environment. Big names like Gina Davis, Jane Fonda, Phil Donahue, Helen Thomas, Jesse Jackson, and Amy Goodman will all be there as well. Visit www.freepress.net/conference to join the party. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL. AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, this final day of 2006. And we're very privileged on this day to have as our guest, probably one of the most popular guests we've ever had on Media Matters, someone who needs not much of an introduction to most people who listen to this program. And for those who aren't aware of her, who listen to the show, I think she will not need an introduction 1 hour from now for the rest of your lives. We're very privileged to have with us the host of Democracy Now!, author of several books, including the recent Static, Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and the People Who Fight Back, Amy Goodman. Amy?
It's great to be with you, Bob.
Well, I can't tell you the sort of treat it is to have us. I know how busy you are. I know the schedule you keep running Democracy Now!, producing that show 5 days a week that's aired all over the country, including right here in Urbana on WRT Radio and on Urbana Public Access Television in the mornings. And knowing now you're writing a newspaper column. Is that right, Amy?
That's right. New weekly column distributed by King Features.
I mean, what? I don't know how you do it. I honestly don't. It's really extraordinary the what you've been able to accomplish in the last decade as a journalist. There are some stories I really want to talk about with you that have been breaking in the last few days, and I'd like to hear your take on them. First of all, and these are all stories that you've covered personally or that Democracy Now! Has been covering for some time. First of all, the controversy surrounding Jimmy Carter's new book, on Palestine, apartheid, peace, not apartheid. What's your take on the book, and what's your take on the media coverage and sort of the way the book has been received by the mainstream media in the United States?
Well, it's interesting. This week we're going to have a major debate on it. We played a speech of Jimmy Carter's that he gave on the book's publication. Almost nowhere in the print press for the first few weeks was there a reference in the news pages and the papers of record like the Washington Post and the New York Times. And yet this is a former U.S. president who has written a book called Palestine, Peace or Apartheid. That's pretty strong stuff. As the president himself, Jimmy Carter, says, it's provocative. It's certainly merited news coverage. But it seems that the answer to this kind of challenge from a former president was, rather than take it on, it was silence. And I think that that's unacceptable. I mean, when you look at all of the discussions about what has to be done in the world today, even the Baker-Hamilton report, it talked about the Palestine-Israel conflict being at the center, really, of it all. We need a full, honest discussion. Now, here is a person who is deeply involved in issues around Israel, Palestine, the Arab world. I think it's worth, you don't have to agree with him by any means, but to hear what he has to say, to hash it out. This week, I encourage people to tune into Democracy Now! We'll have a very vibrant discussion. You also hear Brandeis. President Carter was invited to speak, but then disinvited if he wouldn't have a debate with Alan Dershowitz. That is very ironic, given that this Harvard Law professor, Alan Dershowitz, who said, you know, he shouldn't be afraid to have his ideas challenged, Carter, that is, tried to squelch another book, and that was Norman Finkelstein's book, who is a professor at DePaul University in Chicago, a book called Beyond Chutzpah that took on Alan Dershowitz. The way Dershowitz dealt with Professor Finkelstein's book was by writing a note to the governor of California, that's right, Governor Schwarzenegger, asking him to squelch the publication of Finkelstein's book. It was being published by University of California, Berkeley Press. And technically, I guess it's under the auspices of Governor Schwarzenegger, who's the governor in charge of the state's regents. But to his credit, Schwarzenegger says he does not get involved in an academic freedom issue like that. I think we need to hear what Carter has to say and have vigorous, vibrant, very vocal debate. And the media is a forum for those kind of discussions.
Amy Goodman, from your experience covering the Middle East and covering U.S. Foreign policy, and looking at the way the media around the world cover this issue, how other journalists are covering the Israel-Palestine conflict, how does U.S. press coverage, mainstream press coverage of Israel and Palestine differ from that in other countries, or does it? Or do we have this? Is it pretty much the range of analysis we see in the New York Times or in CNN similar to what one would find in Europe or in Israel or the Middle East?
Well, I think Israel, that's the key. I mean, that's the most interesting comparison. There is a more, there's a broader discussion in the newspapers of Israel, like Haaretz, than there is in the mainstream best press in this country. And that's pretty incredible. I mean, you have reporters, Jewish Israeli reporters like Amira Haas, who've lived in the West Bank and Gaza for more than a decade, who are raising key issues, Gideon Levy as well. They are not raised in this country. These reporters who are Israeli reporters, we do not see or hear in any regular way in the mainstream press of this country. Yes, in the independent press, certainly on Democracy Now! And in other independent programs, you hear these voices. Robert Fisk, one of the leading war correspondents of our generation, or perhaps for many decades, is almost never quoted in the mainstream papers of this country, though he has been voted by British newspaper editors and reporters as the best foreign correspondent year after year. He writes for The Independent of London. We need to have, it is absolutely critical that in civilian society we have discussions about these key issues, because the U.S. is absolutely key in what happens in the Middle East. It's not just between Israel and Palestine. The U.S. has been the so-called broker. And it hasn't been an honest one. Now, the government itself, the U.S. government, they can say what they want, but it's up to the U.S. press not to be a party simply to government spokespeople, whether it's Israel, whether it's U.S. government spokespeople, or frankly, whether it's Palestinian government spokespeople, but to present the full forum of opinion to all of the people involved in this issue.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Amy Goodman, the host of Democracy Now!, the program can be heard locally in Urbana on WORT-FM, the community station, every weekdays at 4, and can be seen on television locally on Urbana Public Television. I think that's Channel 6, 7 a.m., Democracy Now! Every week. Amy Goodman is also the author of a new book, Static, Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and the People Fight Back. And you co-authored that, if I'm to be fair, with your brother.
That's right, with David, both Static and Exception to the Rulers, the book before.
And so the Goodman team has two books out now. And you're also now the weekly author of a weekly newspaper column being syndicated around the country. Unfortunately, not available in Champaign-Urbana, but I know it's available up in Madison, where I spend a lot of time.
Yeah, well, people can ask for it. That's what newspapers are for, to present that full spectrum of opinion. And, you know, we've learned from Democracy Now! Growing, it's just people asking in their communities on public radio and television and Urbana-Champaign, WEFT, and cable access. We are broadcasting on NPR and PBS stations, and the same goes for the column. What we're trying to do is break the sound barrier. And I work with a remarkable group of people. It certainly is not just me that make Democracy Now! Happen every day.
Well, Amy Goodman, if you people want to call in and speak with her, the phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And, Amy, I want to turn now to the death of President Ford this week, and there have been many eulogies and obituaries, reminiscences of President Ford and his administration, including, interestingly enough, a fairly favorable account of President Ford from, of all people, Alexander Coburn and the Counterpunch website. And I thought of Ford because one of the stories you've covered throughout your career, I think only a handful of journalists have approached the issue anywhere near as close as you, has been the Indonesian invasion and occupation of East Timor. And Gerald Ford played a very fundamental role in that. And I wonder if you just take a moment as we think about President Ford, just talk a little bit about that, because this is an episode in American history, regrettably, not many of our journalists paid much attention to.
That's right. And I think it's absolutely key to understand the history. President Ford and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger on December 5th, 1975, went to Indonesia, to Jakarta, the capital, and they met with the long-reigning dictator there, Suharto, who had already been responsible for, it's estimated, from 500,000 to 1 million deaths of Indonesians as he rose to power 10 years before. But they met with him, and it's later come out in documents that have been declassified because of the efforts of a professor named Brad Simpson working with the National Security Archives, that President Ford and Kissinger gave the green light for Indonesia's invasion of Timor a day later. So as President Ford flew out of Indonesia and made his way to Pearl Harbor on the anniversary, December 7th, and talked about how no sovereign country should bomb another or attack another. There was, on that very same day, December 7th, 1975, the Indonesian military invading East Timor by land, by air, and by sea. 90% of the weapons used were from the United States. And what ensued was one of the great genocides of the 20th century. A third of the population of Timor was wiped out. And the U.S. knew full well what was happening every step of the way as they monitored the situation by satellite. It is a very sad chapter of U.S. history. The reason Ford and Kissinger went directly, why it was important to Suharto that he didn't just invade without their direct approval, is because, well, Indonesia was getting weapons from the United States. And he was afraid that it would break bilateral agreements if they used these weapons offensively. But Ford and Kissinger gave him the go-ahead, and he did, with all the brutality and viciousness that Suharto was known for in his own country. He invaded another.
Our guest today, Amy Goodman, you're listening to Media Matters. We're coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, so please do call in. If you have questions for Amy Goodman or comments you'd like to exchange with her, the number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with Amy Goodman.
Hello, I appreciate Democracy Now so much. I was active with Brad Simpson in protesting outside the Indonesian consulate in Chicago.
Really?
All that was going on. I've read Constancio Pinto's book. I've got Jose Ramos Horta's book. And I peeked into the intro to FUNU and saw that very thing that you're talking about. I was so angry that NPR and CBS and so forth didn't even mention the name of Henry Kissinger in any of the coverage of the death of President Ford with all that had happened that year in 75, giving the green light to the invasion with U.S. Arms and support. I have written to NPR news director angry at why they omitted this, and I have told them that I decided to send another check to Democracy Now in lieu of in lieu of sending to them, because I know that you cover it so well. I'm low tech, and I can't get I don't have a computer at home, and the only place I can listen to Democracy Now is when I am home, as I was this past week from work, a college radio station that puts it on at 9 a.m. here, and by that time I'm supposed to be at work. Anyway, best to Brad. I've written him a note, and glad to hear he's done that work with the National Security Archive. I think what we can do as listeners is write letters saying what they have omitted, that we have other sources now, thanks to you and the multimedia outlets, to find information that they are hiding. When they cover the news, they really cover it over.
Well, thank you very much, caller. That's very nice of you to call in. Let's go back to the phone lines now. We've got a couple of people.
I just wanted to make a quick comment.
Sure, please do, Amy.
Brad Simpson is at the University of Maryland, College Park, and those documents that have been declassified are on the National Security Archive website. There is one newspaper that picked up our reports, our interviews with both Brad Simpson and Alan Nairn on the day after President Ford died, and that was the Christian Science Monitor.
Hmm.
And they did an extensive quoting of our broadcast and talked about, even as Ford's criticism of Bush's strategy in Iraq was surfacing, there were media reports reflecting in the late president's foreign policy. And then it quoted Democracy Now! Interviewing Simpson about Ford's role in the backing of the Indonesian generals who illegally annexed East Timor. You're right. It is rarely mentioned, and it absolutely should be, because this is just not a minor footnote in history. This is one of the great genocides of the 20th century. Now, Alan Nairn, my colleague who I went to Timor with in 1990 and 1991, we survived a massacre there when Indonesian soldiers armed with US M-16s opened fire on thousands of defenseless Timorese, killing more than 270 of them on November 12, 91. Alan's skull was fractured in that attack. We also interviewed Alan Nairn that day. He had interviewed President Ford 15 years ago. This was right around 91, 92. And Ford said to him, when Alan asked him about giving the go-ahead, this is before the documents were declassified, that he did not remember this. And Alan had a very interesting point. He said he believed President Ford about what he said, and how remarkable it is that when you're in such a position of power, you know, the President of the United States, that something like this is forgettable when you're talking about the wiping out a third, the decimation of a population.
Our guest today, Amy Goodman. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and WILL AM 580. The phone number here, 333-9455. Toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Again, a live show, so please do call in if you have questions or comments for Amy Goodman. By the way, I don't know if I was exactly clear. Democracy Now! Plays locally here in Urbana, Champaign, on WEFT 90.1 FM, 4 p.m. Every day. And it's on Urbana Public Television, Public Access TV, Channel 6, every morning, I believe, at 7. So that I'm getting the high sign from the producer that I got it right. Okay, so be sure to, if you aren't listening or watching, please do. You'll be glad you did. And there's a website, too, which I go to all the time. And I've got it bookmarked. It's democracynow.org. Is that right?
That's right.
Democracynow.org. Yeah, I'm getting the high sign for that one, too. Let's go back to the phone line now. Line 1, Champaign, you're on the air with Amy Goodman.
Yes, thank you. It's good to have a chance to talk to you. I'd like to kind of go back for a minute to Carter's book. It's coincidentally today's local newspaper, the News Gazette, has a letter to the editor about Carter's book, saying that it only scratches the surface. And besides quotes from Horatz, it also quotes Christopher Hedges, who said that for the question is not whether Israel practices apartheid. Apartheid is a fond dream for most Palestinians, and going on basically to say that, you know, apartheid there is, doesn't really get it, that in fact the things the way they're going are basically going to eliminate Palestine. I just would like to get your comments on that as, you know, analysis of the book.
Well, I think it's interesting that you say you see a letter to the editor. That's what this has been reduced to, is instead of in the news pages, it's people at the grassroots level, and I guess you could call it trickle-up journalism, getting it into the newspaper any which way they can. Christopher Hedges is a very respected journalist. He worked for the New York Times as a foreign correspondent, a war correspondent, for many, many years, is no longer with them. And I think it's important what he has to say. We have to honestly look at the situation with Israel and the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And we have to bring out the voices of Palestinians as well. There is also a peace movement in Israel, and it's important that they be heard. On Democracy Now!, we continually go to the West Bank and Gaza, talk to people on the ground, in the hospitals, doctors and human rights activists, and about the situation. We have to treat it like every situation, heated, as difficult as other situations in the world, and not ignore it. And the reason it's particularly connected to the United States, I mean, Israel's the number one recipient of foreign aid. I don't know if Iraq has surpassed that, the amount of money that's being poured in there. But you could hardly call that foreign aid when you're talking about Iraq. In Israel, it's the number one recipient. And so it matters what the U.S. government does, and it matters what U.S. citizens decide they want how their money is spent.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Cincinnati, you're on the air with Amy Goodman.
Hey, how you doing? I have a question about the discussion earlier. You guys were talking about the difference between political debate in the United States and other countries like Israel, where you're saying that it's actually more open. I was wondering if you could discuss briefly some of the central factors that you think lead to a more stunted political debate in the United States as opposed to other countries. And I'll just take my answer up there. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes. What leads to it is a cowardly media that has completely abdicated its responsibility in this country. We're not supposed to be a party to the parties. We're not supposed to be covering for power. We're supposed to be covering power. We're not supposed to be for the state. We're supposed to be the fourth estate. And the media fails miserably on every count. You look at the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. FAIR did a study, the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting Media Watch Group in New York, of the four major nightly newscasts, NBC, ABC, CBS, and the PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. A two-week period in the lead-up to the invasion, right around Colin Powell giving his address at the UN, 393 interviews done around war. Only 3 were with anti-war leaders. This is unacceptable when half the country was opposed at that time. This is no longer a mainstream media. It is an extreme media. And now, just let's look at today and the last 2 days at the media's coverage of the execution of Saddam Hussein. This is an opportunity to talk about the record. I don't like to talk about the execution as an opportunity, but when the media is around the clock covering this issue, what are we learning about how this tyrant came to power, about how he remained in power, about his role in the Iran-Iraq war, his role in the oppression of his own people? And, you know, he did not do it alone. He did it with the help of the U.S. government. This is something that has almost completely been left out, is what role the U.S. played in. Even as, you know, we talk about his role in the killing, the gassing of Iranians, of his own people, the U.S. was still supporting him. There have been a number of pieces that have come out, and I really encourage people to go to commondreams.org. There are some very interesting ones, among them John Collins, who writes a piece called The Low Profile, CNN and the New York Times Execute a Denial of History. And he talks about watching, for example, Anderson Cooper and watching CNN, you know, the constant roll of footage of his reign of terror, Saddam Hussein's. Do they ever show you the picture that has also become famous, that CNN has rolled before? The video image, the photograph of Saddam Hussein shaking the hand of Donald Rumsfeld in 1983-1984, when Rumsfeld went as an envoy of Reagan and Bush to Iraq to normalize relations with Saddam Hussein. This is very important to understand. How do these tyrants prevail, succeed, despite the will of the people. Well, he had the most powerful country on earth behind him, and that's the United States. If we want to learn from past mistakes, the media has to play an honest role here and tell the truth, not just tell one part of the story.
Yeah, Amy Goodman, one of the things you just mentioned was about the coverage of the war in Iraq, the invasion of Iraq. One of the examples you gave, sort of the poor coverage. It's been sort of a mea culpa period for some of the mainstream news media. The New York Times and Washington Post both have acknowledged they got the story wrong. They did not interrogate the government's claims to justify an invasion of Iraq. They did that, I think, in 2004. Judith Miller is no longer a journalist, one of the prime authors of the weapons of mass destruction articles that sort of presented this as truth when, in fact, it was bogus. Do you think the media, the mainstream press that covers foreign affairs in particular, the networks, CBS, NBC, CNN, as well as the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, do you think these papers now have got it right in Iraq? They learned their lesson, and now they, since in the last year or two and currently, they're really covering the story well. They're nailing it. Or do you think the problems have extended beyond the invasion?
Oh, I mean, well, some call it their mea culpa. We call it their kinda culpas. The New York Times on page A10 did their box where they looked at their past coverage of Iraq. They didn't name names like Judith Miller and other reporters who worked with her. And, of course, it's not just those reporters who have their pieces on the front pages of the paper month after month alleging weapons of mass destruction. They don't place their stories there. The editors do, so it's the entire institution, and we take this on in static. As well as exception to the rulers, because it's just a continual theme. No, they continue to quote power without the dissent. Let's look at Iran. I mean, that is, I guess you could say, the new frontier. We just on Democracy Now! Played an hour of a discussion between Seymour Hersh, the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist who writes now for the New Yorker magazine, and Scott Ritter, who wrote that new book called Target Iran. As warships come closer to Iran, it's very important that we carefully monitor what the press is doing right now, building that same case that we saw building with Iraq. And the way they do it is by icing out dissent. There's some things you perhaps can't absolutely know, but you can bring out the best advice of the experts or the best information. There were many in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq within the military and highest levels of intelligence who felt that the evidence didn't add up. Where were those voices, UN weapons inspectors as well? They're iced out or relegated to a bottom paragraph of a multi-page piece. It is absolutely critical that the media serving a democratic society provides a forum for the full debate, because who ends up going to war? People on military bases around this country who can't have these debates there. Right now, as we speak, we are at 2,999 soldiers dead in Iraq. One more takes it to 3,000 if it hasn't happened already. The number of Iraqis dead, we can only imagine. Johns Hopkins University put out a second study that says they believe, it was printed in the respected British medical journal Lancet, something like 655,000 Iraqis have died, upwards of that number. That is just astounding. That's why it is so critical that we have an independent media, because the lies take lives.
Our guest today, Amy Goodman. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, this final day of 2006 as we get ready for the New Year's Eve festivities this evening. We're talking about media coverage of the big events of our times. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Amy Goodman, the number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We've got a caller who's been very patient, but before we get back to the phone lines, Amy, I do want to turn now to another big issue in foreign policy and U.S. relations with the world and global politics in another corner of the world, and that's Venezuela, a story I know that you've been covering quite a bit at Democracy Now! For the past several years. And what is your take on what's happening in Venezuela, maybe, or even Latin America more broadly, and how it's being presented in the U.S. news media? What are most Americans missing about Latin America that they ought to know if our news media were doing a better job?
Well, first of all, the whole story of Latin America right now is a very interesting one, and I would encourage people to get the latest issue of Extra, the magazine of FAIR, the media watch group, which has a picture of the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, holding Noam Chomsky's book at the UN when he addressed them. And the headline is Venezuela, Hugo Chavez and the Press, and it's by Steve Rendell, one of the top people at FAIR. And he says, when it comes to U.S. press coverage of Venezuela, anything goes if it puts President Hugo Chavez and the movement that brought him to power in a bad light. But among the tangle of misinformation that passes for Venezuela coverage, journalists often tip their hand, telling readers something true. Chavez and the political movement that's gained several electoral victories in Venezuela are a threat to U.S. interests in Latin America. This is the real reason why Venezuela must be treated harshly, even if it means twisting facts. Chavismo represents a major threat to American interests in the region, which we ignore at our peril, says Mort Zuckerman in his column that he runs in the New York Daily News. By American interests, Rendell says, such journalists don't mean what's good for Americans. They mean what's good for American elites, including highly placed media commentators. With this understood, the ways in which the current Venezuelan government threatens American interests are many. And it goes on from there. Also, Joe Kennedy wrote an interesting piece. That is the son of Robert Kennedy, who started the Citizens Energy Group in Boston, saying, yes, we will sell Venezuelan oil, or rather, we will use Venezuelan oil and give it to the poor. You know, Chavez, the Venezuelan government owns Citgo, and here in this country, they have made these inroads in Chicago and New York and Boston, making an offer of oil to the poor of this country. I mean, it's quite astounding. Why aren't U.S. oil corporations doing this? I mean, they are posting the largest profits in the history of the world. Chevron, ExxonMobil. The only corporations they beat out are themselves a year ago. That's the record they break, their own, every year. And especially because this is what motivates so much strife in the world. I mean, what we see in Washington, D.C. is the ascendancy of the oiligarchy. Bush, a failed oil man, Rumsfeld, Cheney, the former head of Halliburton, the largest oil services corporation in the world, the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, having served on the board of Chevron for more than a decade. It's astounding. Is it a surprise that their thirst for oil has taken us from Iraq to Venezuela? We need a media that is honest about what's happening in Venezuela. Not that there isn't controversy around Chavez, but express what is happening on the ground there in the same way that the U.S. media has covered Cuba, but also look at the rest of Latin America and what is happening with the rise of Evo Morales in Bolivia. Extremely significant. You look at Michelle Bachelet in Chile, the first woman president of Chile. Really astounding. This daughter of a general, ultimately killed by Pinochet. She herself tortured, her mother tortured at Villa Grimaldi, this torture center in Santiago. Now, with the recent death of Pinochet, you have this daughter of pain, this woman who is a victim herself, now the president. There is so much that is turning around in Latin America today, and we also have to look at what's happening in Mexico. And being that this is Media Matters, it's important to see what's happened in Oaxaca with the killing of a young journalist, Brad Will, a New York indie media journalist, as he went to cover the continuing upsurge of violence there with the paramilitary forces in Mexico cracking down on this civilian uprising in the southern state of Oaxaca. There's very important trends that are happening in and developing in Latin America that the media is either missing or simply misrepresenting.
Our guest, Amy Goodman. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines to some very patient callers. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. I want to go back to the Carter book on Palestine, since you said you were going to have a number of shows connected to that. You brought up the fact that there was a vigorous debate in Israel about the various issues and positions in various media, Haaretz, etc. But I wonder if you'll also bring up the very vigorous criticism in all Israeli media of Carter's facts, from the left to Haaretz, all the way across the spectrum, of the fact that his book is just full of errors. It's based on errors, and that he just got facts, basic facts wrong, maybe because he had a conclusion that he wanted to come to, and that this same sort of criticism of facts comes from a lot of the players that he discusses, whether it's Ehud Barak, Dennis Ross, etc., etc. So will you give that time as well in your coverage of Carter?
I really would encourage you to tune in this week. We'll have a vigorous debate on the issue. But I think what needs to happen is that there is an open and honest debate in this country. And if there is a problem with Carter's facts, let them come out as well. And let there be a truly honest forum where we can hear the criticisms that a former U.S. president has in all its flaws and its accuracy. I mean, it is not, you know, we don't just have to limit this to Carter's book. There's just not any kind of vibrant debate in this country about what's happening there. The media has shut it down. And that's what should happen.
But Carter, it doesn't matter. I mean, just like you can criticize Ford for all the stuff he did, you can. Carter's got endless, problems with his behavior, both as president and after president. His presidency. So just because he's a former president doesn't give him carte blanche, or doesn't even make him
it doesn't. I mean, you're absolutely right. Just because he's a former president doesn't make him right by any means. You know, let me just bring up Timor. With Ford, you know, he and Kissinger go to Indonesia, give the go-ahead for the invasion, and then Carter becomes president with Mondale as his vice president. Mondale goes to Indonesia. He expedites shipment of U.S. Helicopters and planes that the Indonesian military uses to strafe the Timorese out of the mountainside. That was Carter. I am in no way exonerating Carter in that way. I'm just saying he has written a book. He's a former U.S. president. It certainly merits. Let the New York Times do a front-page piece about the book and about whatever they say, or its flaws and its strengths, whatever. But what the press until recently has been doing is meeting it with silence and the news pages, and I certainly think this is news. So let the debate proceed.
Caller, do you have another point you'd like to raise besides the Carter book?
I want to say one more point about Carter's book, and then I'll get off. I've seen lots in the New York Times and in other media about Carter's book, so I don't get...
Well, when we were running in the first few weeks when the book had come out, at the point where we ran his speech that he gave outside, I think it was in Virginia, and that was 3 weeks into the publication of the book, there was not one news piece. I'm not saying a book review or letter to the editor or perhaps op-ed piece, but a news piece at that time, at the time when it's absolutely key, when a book, you know, when it's determined whether a book will get out there. So I haven't looked in the last week, and I'm certainly going to beef up on it this week as we have our debate. But in the time when the book was published, when it matters, the news pages were silent.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. Amy, it seems that the point you're making is simply that what President Carter is doing in this book, or attempting to do, is simply expand the boundaries of what's permissible debate.
And absolutely.
A lot of this is just about that issue. And, you know, that seems to be that the fact that it's been such a controversial point is striking in its own right. Let's go back to the phone lines again. Some very patient callers. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Amy Goodman. Oh, line 2.
Hello?
I'm sorry. Line 2, are you there?
Hello.
Yeah. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Amy Goodman.
I wanted to ask about Haiti. Amy, you're one of the few journalists that I know that are covering the situation in Haiti. I just returned from 3 months down there, and we'll be going back on the 9th. I look at Haiti, and I look at countries like Somalia and Afghanistan, and Haiti teetering on being a failed state, and certainly Somalia has been there, and Afghanistan is teetering. What do you see as the U.S. and U.N. role in countries like that?
Well, it's absolutely key. Boy, you have a very active audience, Bob, for this person returning to Haiti and having been there. You know, just on Friday on Democracy Now!, and people can check out our site at democracynow.org, we had a discussion with the head of the September 30th Foundation, who is just up from Haiti, who his name was Levinsky, Pierre Antoine, as well as Kim Ives, who is translating for him, about was there another massacre in Cité Soleil? The human rights activists we had on accusing the UN of killing many in a recent attack on a Port-au-Prince neighborhood. And we are seeing this over and over. And it also goes to the role of U.S. troops UN troops in Haiti. BBC recently doing an expose of child abuse and rape by UN troops of girls in Haiti. We had on a Wayne State University student and a professor who had just done a study and definitely implicating the UN troops there. This whole issue of so-called peacekeeping troops has to be looked at, especially when it comes to Haiti. But overall, I mean, the U.S. role in Haiti with the taking out of the former president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, for the second time, February 29, 2004, we write a chapter in Static called Whitewashing Haiti about what has happened there. I mean, this is a country that should be celebrating more than 200 years of independence, born of a slave uprising, the oldest black republic in the world, truly remarkable history, born in 1804, of the U.S. for decades not recognizing Haiti because it was concerned that it would inspire slaves in the United States to rise up. Then you have the first democratically elected leader, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, in 1990. He's taken out in 1991 in a U.S.-backed coup, returned in 1994. He's elected again in 2000 and taken out again in 2004. I went to the place where he was forced into exile, the Central African Republic, where he was being held following a delegation led by Maxine Waters, congressmember from Los Angeles, and Randall Robinson of TransAfrica, who went to take the Aristides back, Mildred Aristide, the First Lady of Haiti, and President Aristide to this hemisphere, and they were brought back to Jamaica, ultimately ended up in South Africa. But the U.S. role in this, as the U.S. was saying, and the U.S. press was simply giving voice to the U.S. government officials who were saying he just up and left the country, which was just an outrage. He was dumped in a remote area of Africa. On February 29, 2004, he told me the story of how the number two man in the U.S. embassy came to his home, said he and his wife could die, thousands of Haitians could die if he didn't leave, and he was hustled onto a plane with U.S. military and security and flown off to Africa. This is a story that must be told.
Our guest is Amy Goodman today in Media Matters. We have a few callers left. I'm going to try to get to all of them, so I'm going to ask them to be brief. And Amy, as you know, I think better than anyone, with the rise of the internet and podcasting, it has expanded the audiences for programs like yours and this one dramatically. This next caller is from London, England. Line one, you're on the air with Amy Goodman.
Oh, Amy Goodman, you are just a great modern American hero. I wanted to ask you if you thought that somehow stations like Link TV could be used for some kind of an interactive vehicle to bring in more and more people into the media with all their different talents there's so many who want to actually help to contribute to dethroning these cast of war criminals and civil rights abusers and so on.
Well, Link TV, which is an independent channel on both Dish Network, Channel 9410, and
DirecTV, Channel 375, Free Speech TV, which is 9415 on Dish Network. These are very important channels in the satellite TV world. Of course, the web, very, very important. In fact, how do you listen to Democracy Now or watch Democracy Now?
Well, you know, I'm afraid to save her phone bill, she's
okay.
Listening now, so...
So she's listening online. We have to build independent media, and yes, they can be used to tell the truth. That's critical, and it also goes to an issue that Bob Free Press, of course, has worked very hard on, and that is the issue of net neutrality, why it is so important that we keep the Internet open and free. And I really encourage people to come out to Memphis, Tennessee, the weekend of January 12th through 14th for, is it the third annual?
They're every 18 months, so third quasi-annual.
Well, that's very important because thousands of people are there to fight for media democracy, and especially as so many people get information from the web, to ensure that the telecommunications companies, that the cable industry does not privatize this absolutely critical, I'm not even going to say national treasure, it's international, it's global, it's the way we communicate with each other around the world.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. We have a caller also quite patient. Line 4, LaSalle, you're on the air with Amy Goodman.
Hi, Amy. I love you much. But either way, I have two things where I feel that the press, the media, does not publicize. And the one was before the first Gulf War, when April Grassley interviewed Saddam Hussein when we were buddies with him. He said that Kuwait was slant drilling his oil, and would the United States matter if he went after them? And she said, no, that's a civil matter. And another one that Christopher Hitchens, when his expose of Kissinger and Nixon, when they went into Chile, and that they were responsible for the overthrow of Allende and the killing of General Snyder. I don't hear anything about that.
Well, tune into Democracy Now! Because we certainly talk about both of these issues. The whole issue, of course, of the U.S. involvement in the overthrow of the democratically elected leader of Chile, Salvador Allende, on another September 11th, 1973, when he died in the palace, and the U.S.-backed, Nixon-backed, Kissinger-backed, ITT-backed Pinochet forces rose to power. Absolutely key. And the first point was?
Oh, about April Glaspie.
Oh, April Glaspie, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq at the time that Iraq invaded Kuwait. Yeah, this is a key conversation. I think it took place in July of 1990 when the message could have been extremely strongly sent that the U.S. would not tolerate Iraq invading Kuwait. But instead, she said, the U.S. doesn't intervene in what it considers an internal matter or a matter between these two countries. And then we saw what happened. Of course, the U.S. attacked Iraq. That's a key conversation that should continually be raised to understand what was the U.S. role at this time.
You know, Amy Goodman, one of the big stories of 2006, I think, in American politics and American journalism was the November election and the Democrats taking control of both the House and Senate, and I think seen as pretty much a dramatic renunciation of the Bush administration. At least that's been the perception. And you mentioned the Carter book coming out, and one of the things that was striking when Carter's book came out was how quickly the Democratic Party ran from it and washed their hands of having any connection to former President Carter.
That's right. Nancy Pelosi, who will become the Speaker of the House, as well as many other Democrats running away from it. And I think that what's critical overall here is, will the Democrats turn things around? And I think it's very clear as they take a number of different issues off the table, what's going to matter now is people's participation all over this country. As Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. And I think that's what needs to happen right now. Whether the Democrats will continue to kowtow to enable the administration, because I think the Republicans who raise this are very fair in raising this. The Republicans didn't do this alone. Bush didn't do this alone. The Democrats voted to authorize the invasion as well. It was Hillary Rodham Clinton. It was John Kerry. It was John Edwards. Kerry and Edwards having just recently said they were wrong in this. Hillary Rodham Clinton, you know, considered one of the top runners for 2008. We have to open up the debate even around who are candidates in this. It's not just about two parties. There are other parties, and we have to expand the discussion. And when the media acts as an honest, open forum, it puts politicians on the line. It allows them to be challenged in ways that they are not usually challenged. Instead of being protected and insulated by the press, they should be challenged by the press. They should be held accountable.
Amy Goodman, our guest today. We've only got a few minutes left, Amy, to talk. And, you know, I'd like to end, if we could, briefly on an issue you and I have spoken about in our personal conversations, about the struggles you've had explaining your journalism to public and community radio station and television stations, that quickly sort of, because you're critical of the United States government, as you've been in this show, have dismissed you as not being objective or professional, but rather partisan. You and I have talked about this. I think that's a mischaracterization of your journalism. But I'd like you to have a chance to explain how you see your journalism.
Well, I mean, I think the media are the most powerful institutions on earth, more powerful than any bomb, more powerful than any weapon. And the Pentagon has deployed the media, and we have to take it back. For journalists to express their points of view is nothing new. We see it on television every day, 24/7, on every single network. But what matters is that we are fair and accurate and bring out a full spectrum of opinion. We have a special responsibility as U.S. journalists, and that is to hold accountable the most powerful government on earth. It's not a comfortable position. You know, we are not there to party with the parties. We're supposed to be separate from them. And I think it's also absolutely critical that journalists honestly provide a forum for and chronicle the movements of our time. It's not just about individuals, the movements that make history. And that's what I see our role as, too. It doesn't mean we agree with each person we interview, but to provide a voice for those who are not usually heard, this is also our role. It is not our role to simply be there as a conveyor belt for the lies of the powerful, and too often we see that in the corporate media.
Our guest today, Amy Goodman. Amy, what are you working on now? Do you have any major projects in addition? Not like you're taking the year off, I understand. But in addition to your radio and TV show and column, do you have any book plans or any major projects in mind?
Well, right now we are expanding our studios at the Firehouse in downtown Manhattan and Chinatown as we build this independent media center. And so we've just moved into, well, just moved from the first to the third floor of downtown community television so we can revamp our whole first floor digs to make it possible for people, young people and old, to be able to train in independent journalism. Also, we are translating our newscast portion of Democracy Now! Into Spanish and scores of stations, close to 100 now throughout Latin America, the United States, and Europe, are taking our Spanish headlines, and any radio station in the United States can do that, and we'll soon be doing that with our TV broadcast as well.
Amy Goodman, I have here the band tuning up in the background, which means they're clearing me out of the studio. You know what that's like. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Bob. See you in Memphis.
See you in Memphis, and thank you, listeners. I want to thank Colleen Cook, my producer today, Brett Polson, the engineer. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back 1 week from today with Judy Dobbin-Meyer, editor of the new book, Project Rewire. Until then, everyone, party safely. Happy New Year.